quick announcement. Linguistics Career Launch 2024 is happening this summer. It will be a two-week event taking place online from July 15th through July 26th, 2024. This is a boot camp that takes linguists in training and in transition from coursework to career through panels, courses, guest speakers, and networking events. Check out our website at linguisticscareerlaunch.com for more information, and then join us July 15th to the 26th, 2024, to access the career management methods you need to research and apply to jobs that use linguistics in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. Today's interview is part of a series of talks with elder career linguists, as we're calling them. Linguists who received their degrees in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, and who have been employed in industry since that time. Opportunities for them were scarce, and academic support was nearly non-existent. Yet these linguists made places for themselves outside the academy. There's a lot we can learn from their journeys. Peter Benson received his PhD in linguistics from UC San Diego in 1973, in addition to studying neuroscience, neuropsychology, and computer science. He's worked on speech recognition, user interface, and artificial intelligence. He had a long career in aerospace communications, while also navigating life as a single parent. He is now retired and pursuing a life of gardening, woodworking, philosophy, and crossword puzzles. Topics discussed include neuroscience, neuropsychology, single parenthood, financial concerns, work environment, user interface, computer science, and speech recognition. The link to Peter's LinkedIn profile is in the show notes. I would like to welcome Peter Benson to the podcast. Peter is someone who has been in industry for a very long time, but has a degree in linguistics, and we wanted to feature him as someone who can speak to kind of the long view of getting a linguistics degree, amongst other degrees, and then how that worked out for you as you went into your career. So first of all, thanks so much for spending the time with us today. I think this is going to be really interesting.
My pleasure.
I always ask people this question, and I'm curious to see your answer. When did you find out what linguistics was? Like, what got you so interested in linguistics that you actually wanted to pursue it as a degree?
Good question. I can't recall exactly, but I would say it was when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And I took courses in linguistics at Johns Hopkins.
And did you know anything about linguistics before you started taking classes? Like, did you have other languages, or were you studying English? Like, how did you come to those classes?
So I had studied French in high school and in college, and German in college, and Russian in college.
Okay.
So I was interested in languages. I was especially interested when I was younger in etymology. That's something which I retain. I still am interested in etymology, but I never took a historical linguistics course, so I probably don't do it right. I guess the transformative thing for me was I got a part-time job at Johns Hopkins University Hospital in the neurocommunications laboratory. Uh-huh. Which was studying child language acquisition, phonetics, a little bit of neuroscience insofar as mm-hmm. lateralization of function is a neuroscience. So I was doing that, and that was, I liked that. And that was it slipped my right into wanting to study linguistics.
And at the time, were there any classes that specifically focused on that confluence of linguistics and neuroscience? Because that's pretty new back then, right?
No, there were none. Well, let me take that back.
Okay.
It's not exactly linguistics but I took a research seminar in speech and hearing sciences, which was uh-huh. really important. And I really enjoyed that. But that wasn't about linguistics.
And just to give us a time frame on this, about what year was this when you started taking linguistic classes?
1967, 68.
And so you were on the East Coast. Were you aware at all of like what Chomsky was doing and how linguistics was sort of coming to the fore at that point?
My major professor, who was a psychologist, James Deese, had us read Aspects of a Theory of Sensex. I could barely keep my eyes open because I found them really boring. But
Same.
so there was that.
Yeah, okay, interesting. So you took some courses in linguistics. What just kind of lay out for us what happened after that as far as your academic training?
I was talking with somebody at a colloquium, and he said to me, I should investigate what was happening at UCSD if I was going to graduate school, because he thought what was happening there was really interesting. I have a remark to pass about that. But let's say I applied to UCSD and the University of Texas at Austin and Cornell, and UCSD gave me the biggest scholarship, fellowship sort of thing. So, and it was very rainy in Baltimore that year, so the idea of going to a place with 9 inches of rain was really intriguing.
And that was in the neuroscience program?
No. God, we should have that. No, that was in linguistics. I started my graduate program in linguistics, 1969, I guess.
Do you remember what you thought your trajectory was going to be at that point?
Because of the way that NDA Title IV fellowships were set up, they were pretty much designed for you to become college teachers. The program was set up to be able to teach, to get people to be able to teach in these areas that they thought were important. And one of them they thought was important was linguistics.
And at the time, did that seem like a career you wanted? Like you wanted to stay in academia?
I had been doing kind of research in at the neuropsychology, neurocommunications laboratory, and I liked that. I enjoyed working with the people I worked with there. And then I kind of branched out when I got to San Diego.
Okay, so you finished your PhD.
No, let's if you want to really follow this,
Oh, yeah, please go. Detail is what we want. Go into
okay,
detail.
so when I came to UCSD, it was a linguistics program. I got to study the American Indian language. I got to do I worked with Bob Galambos in the neurosciences department, worked on evoked potentials and lateralization. I took courses in psychology and sensory mechanisms. I learned a lot of stuff, but I wasn't particularly excited about the linguistics that I was learning. I felt like phonology at that point was like doing a complicated but interesting crossword puzzle.
I totally agree with that. I have felt exactly the same way. When I was in school, I vastly preferred phonetics to phonology because phonology just felt like moving pieces around on a board.
So the person I studied with was Tim Smith. He was a person interested in physiology of language production, and I wasn't interested in sticking needles in my tongue, which is what, so I was more interested in speech perception. So I wish in some ways that I had applied to UCLA, where a person I knew, Peter Ladefoged, was working, and I could have learned a lot from him. But Tim was just hadn't finished his doctorate, so he was not well plugged in, and he was not a great teacher. He was not a great mentor. That's what I should say. So I did that, and then we were doing good work with Bob Galambos on evoked potentials and language. And my role in that turned out to be mostly working on solving computer problems, in the sense that we needed to have programs that presented and recorded a stimuli and what have you, so that you could get a measure of how people were hearing or listening to speech samples. And I did, and so that's and I did a lot of programming in Fortran or in assembler, and so that was the beginning of my background in computer science. Interest in neuroscience, interest in computers, interest in language. interested in, like in those kinds of things. So it, had there been a school of cognitive science at that point, I would have fit right in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So since there wasn't a school of cognitive science, yeah, where did you go from there?
So Irv Pollack, who is a psychologist, said, why don't you apply for this position at the University of Michigan Computer and Communication Sciences Department? That was a well-known program in the beginning of the 50s, and it had fallen into disrepair, let's say. The part that I wouldn't be interested in. So I went there. They were kind of interdisciplinary systems programming kind of thing, or systems, that's not programming, but systems analysis. And they wanted to have people who could teach a course in natural language systems, which I did, which was kind of on one track was going to be about linguistics, and on another track would be about language processing. So I made up the course and taught that. But mostly what I did is teach basic programming in first Fortran and then in Algol. I tried to teach other little courses on the side, but people in my department were interested in becoming computer scientists and not in having anything to do with language.
Did you enjoy that, being a teaching and putting those courses together?
I didn't think I knew enough to do what I was doing. So I don't know that I would say enjoy. I mean, I like the people. I like the people in Michigan. They were good folk. And I did good stuff with those people. But what I was doing was not fulfilling, I'd say.
Yeah. I am driving towards your decision to leave academia. With some people, it's been kind of a gradual thing where they were doing postdocs or had actually gotten hired, and it just kind of crept up on them that this wasn't the right fit. With other people, there was an inciting incident where it suddenly, the light broke over their heads and they went, this is wrong. I need to be doing something else. So I'm curious what it felt like for you when you finally made the decision to leave.
Okay, a key and direct differentiating aspect of my life is in 1970, I became a single father, and I had two girls, four and one, that I had to take care of and raise. And so I needed, what was really important to me is to have enough money to, get child care and things like that.
Yeah, of course.
So I would say that I did not get paid particularly well at University of Michigan. It was more than I was paid as a postdoc, but it wasn't great. Anyway, so part of the reason I was looking around was that I wanted to be able to have a life with a house and childcare and all of that kind of good stuff. So I made a lot of tactical decisions to make a life. Let's leave it that way. Because I kept going to the Acoustical Society, I had friends in the speech recognition and speech processing area. So when they were opening up a new lab in San Diego, I went, whoopee, I will apply for that. I did. They accepted me. But that was funny because they really needed somebody who did signal processing, not just speech. And the key element in that, I think I would point out, is the IBM program in speech recognition was run by a man named Fred Jelinek. And he has been quoted as saying, every time I hired a linguist, my recognition scores went down. Every time I hired a statistician, they went up. So, and you see that today in ChatGPT and those things. Those are all big statistical engines. They are not linguistic engines.
Right, right.
So linguistics helped me in very glancing ways. I would say, for example, let's take something simple, like working with informants in a native, Luis Seno is the language we worked on. You learned how to talk with people and ask them good questions. And that was a big part about, helping people formulate user interfaces. I think Nancy Frischberg, is a person that would agree with that.
And this is, I mean, I've talked to a number of people, and this is what they do now, that they use their linguistic training to facilitate things like market research or interviews with people to build a database, getting at subtle things and subtle ways of communicating that people who don't have linguistic training don't necessarily know about.
Right.
This is still a huge area where linguists are very desperately needed in industry.
Right. And that's good. And I understand that. The way that industry looked at user interfaces in the 1970s, especially for a defense contractor, was that it was beside the point. You were only interested in how powerful your speech processing engine was.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it didn't perform at 100% was not the fault of the user interface.
Mm-hmm. So you had this position. Now I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile right now, and it says that you eventually made your way to aerospace communications. So can
That's
you
right.
tell us how that happened?
That was pretty much what I was saying before. I kept up my association with the Acoustical Society of America, mm-hmm. and that's where I met Bob Wilford and a number of other people, and they invited me to apply for a position of, you know, a senior member of the technical staff kind of position with mm-hmm. ITT in San Diego. The ITT operation in San Diego was a engineering satellite. The real company was back in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
But for a variety of very arcane reasons, it was something which really appealed to me.
Did it feel like, just in terms of the, you were talking before about how you wanted to have a life and a house and stability and get paid pretty well. Did it feel like this job was the realization of that?
Yes. Oh, it was. Let's just tick off the things. I got enough money. And the transition from Michigan to ITT that allowed me to put a down payment on a house with a second mortgage at 18%.
Uh-huh.
I lived in an appropriate place with a house in a suburb of San Diego, and I found people that would watch the kids when I needed them to. And I had enough money to pay those people.
It feels to me, and other folks have said this as well, that the expectations in industry about what your life should be like are really vastly different from academia in terms of, you know, things like stability and owning a house and how much time that you have to devote to work. Did you feel that that was the case for you?
In the beginning, it was clear to my bosses that if I had a problem with the kids, I could go take care of that. And since I was a single parent, that was important. They were generally understanding, but I did work long hours when it was appropriate. You know, as in, you have a proposal due. You know, and I work really long
right.
hours. But I raised my girls to be as independent as I could.
They had a great example, so there you go. So what's interesting to me about your career as well, and I do want you to talk about the kind of work that you've been doing, is just that you were at the same company for a long time. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. You know, most people, when they get a job, like, you expect to be in a place for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years at the most. So do you feel like the fact that you were with the same company for a long time, what kind of advantages do you feel like that had as far as, you know, the practical side of it, but also the ability to move within a company? Did you get to do that, to explore different things within the same framework?
I did. You know, the fact that they realized at some point that my skills were not central to their mission was accommodated by having me do other things, and they were not typically not linguistic. So in 1986 or 85 or so, they needed somebody who would look into the applications of artificial intelligence for their problems. Now, they didn't have problems that were really amenable to artificial intelligence, and I didn't have the skills, so I took courses in artificial intelligence. But nothing I did was worthwhile, I thought, you know, so we stopped doing that after a while. The reason I stayed with ITT, of course, is because of pensions and things like that. If you change careers because you change your pension, change to a different place, you may lose important aspects of your pension. So I was being very practical about those things and willing to put up a lot of not terribly interesting stuff. I made my nest a different way. I made my nest by being part of the society in that lab.
So can you talk about the kinds of work that you did and whether or not linguistics was part of it? Like, was there stuff where linguistics was part of it?
Oh, sure. Here's an example. At that time, we had a speech recognizer that operated on phrase structure grammars. And so I put together a set of programs that allowed us to create what I call speechware for our recognizer that made it easier for somebody who was not a linguist or it's not even a linguist, somebody who is a subject matter expert to be able to create a phraseology that they could use to put inside the recognizer so that it would recognize speech.
When you were doing this, were you the only linguist who was there?
I was the only linguist. Yes, absolutely.
Were you the only linguist the whole time you were working there?
Yes.
Really? Wow. Like, you couldn't evangelize them and convince them to take some other linguists on board?
Well, what we did was, no, we couldn't. There was one big project where we had to phonetically transcribe some things, and I hired people that I didn't have to train. They were hearing, speech and hearing graduate students. And so if that's, and that we also hired people who were in the cognitive science program at UCSD to do some work for us like that. And that was good. I enjoyed doing that.
Oh, how interesting. This is a very subjective question, but did you feel lonely being the only linguist?
No, I didn't. But, I mean, the principal engineers and thinkers in the group were Jack, Steven, Ed, and I. And we arranged to run 5 miles 3 times a week. Uh-huh. And so I had people who cared about me and were good people that I hung with. And that was one of the reasons I stayed in ITT as long as I did, because I had good friends.
Yeah, that's so important. One of the things I've talked about with people is the importance of finding a place where you can work on a team, right? Sometimes coming out of academia, where you're used to working on your own a lot, it can be difficult to find a group of people like you did, obviously, that you get along with, that you can work with, and maybe build some personal ties as well. And that's not a thing that gets talked about very much, but is so crucial to finding a job where you can stay for, the practical benefits that you talked about, like pensions and things, but also where you feel like you're welcome, right? You're not on the outside, or there aren't people who are undermining you. You actually have a little core of people who you could call friends.
Oh, absolutely. I have two things to say, and you'll help me remember what they are to say. So one of the things is, how do you build a fun environment to work in? And I made a point, I used to throw parties, and people would come to the parties, and they would say that really important. It was important for them in work that we had these outside of the office relationships. Those were good, and I was good at creating those. But the other side of this, and this is now I'm remembering what I was about to say, and that is that I was always kind of outside. I was always doing things which were interdisciplinary. And so I didn't have a group of people in my quote-unquote field to work with. Mm-hmm. And I was working on the edge. And I would have to form relationships with people in the speech and hearing department at Michigan, right, or the psychology department. So I would reach out and do that. But that wasn't good for me in terms of my academic career. Believe it or not, just it didn't help.
Yeah. I think that kind of, I will call it marginalization, even though it's not quite the same. It happens for a lot of people for different reasons at different universities, whether because it's your interdisciplinary like you were, or because of things like class differences or race differences or even gender differences. And when you don't feel like you're part of the thing, it just puts an added level of stress and an added burden on you to do your best work. And when people don't have that, it's a lot easier for them to thrive. It's one less thing to worry about.
Well, I mean, keep in mind that I was a single parent during this time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I maybe didn't have the same drive that somebody who is, you know, really deeply interested in Sanskrit or something like that, and they knew what the problems were because they had a good mentor to have them focus on what the real problems were that we're trying to solve in the Sanskrit societies. I just didn't see things that way. I thought sort of things, unfortunately, as how can I solve this with my computer?
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to be presumptuous about your position, but it very much strikes me from everything I know that the model at the time was if you were an academic, you were going to be a male. You were going to have a wife who took care of everything for you so you could devote yourself to doing the academic stuff. And you didn't have to worry about small things like childcare or who's making dinner tonight. And I mean, you weren't that. You didn't have a person to take care of everything for you. You personally had to take care of that. And I think for most of the people in the department, that would have been very different from the lives that they were leading.
And they were the people in my department, in the computer and computer science department, understood that, but they didn't care. I mean, how do they put it? Result. They say so-and-so, Rosenthal, got a good result. And that meant that he or she had solved the mathematical problem in a way that it could be called a result. Mm-hmm. And that was really important. And I wasn't doing that. I was doing experimental stuff. Which they just didn't appreciate. And when they had graduate students who did stuff, and their approach to experimental design was so poor, we would get into their thesis reviews, and I would try to persuade them that maybe I should teach a course in experimental design. They say, "Oh no, we're not interested in that." So there you go.
Yeah, we'll do the experiments anyway. They'll just be done badly. So that's fine.
Right. I mean, and I would want to have my name on them.
Right, exactly. It sounds very frustrating. So can you talk a little bit about maybe give an overview or cite some specific projects that you did at ITT that were, I don't know, particularly interesting or meaningful to you?
One that I was took an existing system and restructured it so that it could be used by non-professionals. We were selling our system to non-professionals, so I created a way to do that. That was fun. I enjoyed doing that. The AI stuff was never in a good place where it would be worthwhile talking about. And going to present papers or presentations about speech recognition was the opposite of being fun. It was terrifying because you would go and present, you'd go and do a presentation about, well, this system works, and then you'd find that it didn't work, and it didn't work in front of generals or colonels or things like that. Sure. And that was awful for me.
Was there any work that you ended up doing that was more linguistically focused than other things? I'm trying to present this in a way that if there are folks who are listening who are interested in sort of what you were doing, they could maybe get a handle on what a career might look like for them. Even given that, you know, what you did was years ago, there's still a need for linguists. I've spoken with people who work in government. I haven't spoken with anyone who's worked in aerospace, but I feel like there are definitely would be places for people who have linguistic training to maybe work on the same kinds of things you did, or maybe there are different things now.
If somebody had a degree in linguistics and you were going to ask them, what would you do now? I would tell them, learn how to program. Be somewhat computer savvy because that's going to be important whatever you're going to do. Learn how to do user interface design as well. Something like that would be probably more in your line, but you're not, and I don't really follow the ChatGPT stuff. I don't know how. There is this thing of prompt engineering that people do, and I don't really. I haven't done that, so I don't know what it is, but it sounds like something that a linguist would be able to do.
Absolutely. User interface is interesting because more and more, everything in our lives, because we're all connected to the internet and computers and mobile devices, is a user interface. So any place that you touch something, there's got to be some aspect of user interface in it. I know a number of people who have got jobs doing that or are trying to convince their employers that linguists should be employed to do certain types of user interface. And even this is something that our mutual connection, Nancy Frischberg, talks about is
Right.
the user interface of a voting ballot, right? Like that's classic user interface because you're producing something for a user to look at and work with, and it has to be done in such a way that you're conveying the information accurately without bias attached to it. And when she told me about that, I'd never really thought about it before, and I was like, yeah, that's a great way that linguistics plays into something that's like not computer related. It's on a piece of paper that you get mailed to you at your
Right.
home.
So anyway, I think that your remarks are to the point, and I agree. But again, I would say that I have not been doing this particular kind of work for a long time, so I don't know what the current issues
Sure,
are.
sure. So, what have you been doing since you left ITT?
Oh my goodness. Let's see. Well, in 1991, my wife and I got married. Okay, so we bought a place in northern San Diego County, and has 2.5 acres, and I've
Wow.
been becoming a gardener, and I also took courses in woodworking, and I set up a we call it the philosophers group. Actually, I started it with the end at the end time of UC at ITT, where we took some people who were interested in thinking about quote unquote deep topics, and we got together once a week, and we do it now using, I guess we use Google Meet to form, because we have people in Portland and people in England, that we talk with each week. So that's another thing. So gardening, woodworking, philosophy, let's call it, although we're going to be studying economics in this next little while.
It sort of feels like keeping your hand in a little bit of academia in like a friendly way.
Yes, exactly.
Do you keep up with any linguistics at all? Like, is there something that still has an attraction for you?
Other than the crossword, I mean, phonotactics plays in a part in doing the crossword.
For sure. It's interesting to me how some linguistic stuff is in the mainstream now, and it's I find it fascinating how people write about it when they're talking about political language, or even just recently, as been happening here and around the world, the language of protest, right? And who gets to use the word genocide, things like that. That's all linguistics. And in so many cases, as we say, you really need a linguist for that. People who don't understand how language works should not be opining about these things.
Right. Yeah. So the short answer is I don't do any. There's nothing drives people running away faster than telling them about the etymology of some particular word.
Oh, it depends who you're talking to. I would love to hear about that. I mean, it like I think if you have friends who have similar interests, I mean, talking about etymology, people who are into Tolkien, like
Oh,
they
yeah.
live for that stuff, right? Like you could spend entire days talking with people about language and etymology and how things get used in that particular frame.
Yeah, right. Well, you have to memorize that, go back and reread stuff I haven't read in a long time. There is one guy in the group, the philosophers group, who has a degree in linguistics. Oh no, there's two. There's two. and they're fun to talk with. But the people who are not linguists get bored very quickly with whatever we talk about.
Yep, no, I totally get that. It's great to talk shop, but other people don't like to hear it very much.
Whatever the shop is. I mean, another thing I like is native plants. Yeah, I like to hike, and native plants are what you see alongside the trail, and I'd like to know what I'm walking through. So, I was talking with somebody about this at one point, telling him, oh, look, there's red-breasted la-di-da. He said, not everybody wants to hear the name of all the plants. So I learned that was an important lesson for me to learn.
I get it. I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Do you have any regrets at all about leaving academia?
My wife she eventually became a vice president for student affairs at the local Cal State. And so I still rub shoulders with other people in that area. And that's fun. So that part of that, I still can get some access to. Mm-hmm. It's only a question of distance, but it's a question of how getting over for colloquia would be fun. That would be especially fun at UCSD because they have stuff that I would be interested in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's great. Okay. Well, I think those are all the questions I have today. Is there anything we haven't discussed that you'd like to get in there, or any parting words of advice?
I think you have to be open to doing things which are not if you studied Etruscan, be prepared that Etruscan is not going to figure into your day-to-day work for somebody else. Mm-hmm. You have to show your value to them. Mm-hmm. And you have to figure out what it is that they need from you that will be valuable.
Yep, absolutely. That's a great piece of advice. Well, again, Peter, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it. Is it okay if we put your LinkedIn link in the show notes for this in case people want to contact you perhaps with questions?
Well, they can try that. And I'll try to answer them truthfully.
Okay, that sounds great. People often do have questions when they hear about your journey, they're might be asking for advice, or they might just want to, get a little more data on something.
Okay, sounds all right.
Great. Linguistics Career Launch 2021 was a one-month intensive program intended to familiarize linguistics students and faculty with career options beyond academia in business, tech, government, and nonprofit organizations. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. LCL 2021 was organized by Nancy Frischberg, Alexander Johnston, Emily Pace, Susan Steele, and Laurel Sutton. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.